You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, and it is a stormy night here in rural western Pennsylvania. And I am, of course, Matthew Brunfield Johnson, who has been the voice behind the lecture series, The Orthodox Nationalist, for a very long time, since I think 2008. And today, we are going to jump straight into the subject matter, which is part two of Lev Tikhomirov's book on monarchist statehood. And if we have time, get a bit into his Why I'm No Longer a Revolutionary, which he wrote in 1988. For those of you who have not heard part one, Tikhomirov, who died in 1923, was a terrorist revolutionary. He was a member of the executive committee of the People's Freedom Organization, formerly Land and Liberty. He was even sent to the Peter and Paul Fortress for 4 years. But the murder of Alexander II changed things. He fled to Switzerland, and he reconsidered everything. He repented of his revolutionary activities, and he wrote the book I just mentioned, Why I'm No Longer... It's not really a book. It's an essay. Why I'm No Longer a Revolutionary, and that was in 1888, and he did an addendum a few years later. Then he became one of the most significant figures in royalist Orthodox nationalism in Russia, and really in Eastern Europe as a whole. After the revolution, he never left his country. He stayed under the radar. He withdrew from politics after 1917. His work is essential for understanding both the revolutionaries on the one hand and the royalists on the other. So we ended last week with Ivan the Terrible. I disagree with a few things he has to say about Ivan, but I agree, of course, with the general thrust of what he's saying. And we left somewhere around the battle with Ivan Kurbsky. Now, there is some question as to the whether or not that correspondence is genuine. But most scholars think it is. But I want to mention something about, you know, he says, actually Tikhomirov says, and I'm quoting from him directly. He says, Ivan Andrei Kurbsky, an opposition figure who defected to the Polish cause. Well, it's a little more than that. At the beginning of the Livonian Wars, the commander of the Russian army was Kurbsky. He was bought by the Polish oligarchy, and he sent information about Russian troop formations to the Poles. April 1563, he fled to Lithuania. The information that he was able to give led to the defeat of the Russian army on January 25th, 1564, near the town of Ula. So, he arrived at the border. I mean, when he ran, he didn't run with... I mean, he was bought, and I mean it. He had 30 ducats, 300 gold coins, 500 silver talers, and 44 Moscow rubles. It doesn't seem like a lot, but at the time, that was a huge amount of money. That was his 30 pieces of silver. As I've said some weeks ago, he fled also his wife and son. And I'm pretty sure that when he arrived, the estates that Sigismund gave him, there were plenty of Polish and Lithuanian women to take his mind off that. He was given rich estates. Nevertheless, he is considered and is perpetually considered as the sign of Russian liberty, defender of Russian rights. There were still plenty of lawsuits with his neighbors, even his second wife. And his works are Four Letters to Ivan the Terrible, 1564, 1579. The History of the Great Prince of Moscow on the Deeds We Heard from Trustworthy Authors and Which We've Seen with Our Own Eyes, 1581, 1583. And these are guilt-ridden fantasies. Many Russians died because of him. Now, I could only assume, I mean, let's just assume he's not a sociopath. He was loaded with guilt. So he was more than just someone who defected to the Polish side. He was a commander of the Russian army. But using Ivan as an icon of a good monarch is an excellent idea. Just a few weeks ago, I did one on Emperor Basil II in Byzantium. I've done one on Basil III in Russia, who tends to get overlooked, the great Ivan III. There are many of them. The 18th century saw that disappear for a while, with the exception of the Empress Elizabeth. Russia was given a break there. It was resurrected only with Tsar Paul, who was a saint and it's been canonized, who was also murdered to make way for Alexander the First. Now, monarchs, unless they die suddenly, write a will or what's called a testament. And these are always political. And this is what he says to his sons. Know the Orthodox faith and suffer for it fervently, even to death, and live in grace. Become skilled in every matter, divine, priestly, monastic, military, judicial, in all matter of practical life, and how various ranks are conducted here and in other states, how a man lives, how it is fitting for a man to be. You must learn all things so that others will not dictate to you, but you will dictate to them. Besides that, it befits a czar to have three things. Not to be angry with God out of misfortune, not to be arrogant towards death, and to be long-suffering towards those who sin. In other words, patient with sinners. Elsewhere, Ivan wrote that the worst vice a czar could display is pride, pomposity, and certainly self-interest, arbitrary action towards the people who were entrusted to him by God are almost as evil and really come from it. Christian love, mercy, and justice. Now you notice mercy and justice are two different things. Justice is a very cold, everyone's given what they're due. Mercy is when someone is forgiven. It's like a pardon. And so not everything can be based on justice. Some must be based on mercy. Ivan believed that czars should possess moral fortitude, a tact with the bureaucracy, and again, a compassionate attitude towards human weakness. But everything written today about Ivan, as I've said many times before, has no bearing on reality whatsoever. The people of his day, however, remembered him as a czar, merciful to his loyal subjects, but formidable towards the enemies of Russia and the church. for centuries after his death. People came to his grave, prayed to him for fair trial, for that trial coming up, assistance for in a fair trial, or assistance from unjust judges. And miracles coming from him were recorded in a special notebook there in the small chapel. Now, Tikhomirov is really laying out the historical understanding that led him away from revolutionary activity. And one of the important things is something called the Zemensky Sobor, the Council of the Land, the Assembly of the Land. These were called a few times. There were national assemblies of all classes, the aristocracy, you know, princes, boyars, the rest, the clergy, and the peasants. The first was convened by Tsar Ivan in 1549. He was only 19, but he knew that stability was necessary. It was a way to reconcile with the oligarchs. But even during his minority, the country was ruled by boyars and oligarchs led by the prince Ivan Belsky. That period of time, very typical, without a strong czar, or really a czar at all, they imposed tremendous taxes. They were on the verge of rebellion. And so in convening this assembly, Ivan said he is going to abolish all of this, and he's going to rule with justice and mercy. He made a speech on Red Square. Red Square has nothing to do with Marxism. It has to do with the bricks that make it up. And what he said was for class society, because class society is inevitable, should come together for the sake of building a Russian national state. He was very clear about the nation of that Russia is a nation, and a nation is a family, and he is the father. He wanted to create distinct branches of government, you know, a certain power for the aristocracy, and local self-government, which is purely elective. But he also knew he had to curtail the powers of the princes and the boyars, which essentially were oligarchs at this point. He eliminated some of the privileges of the old boyar families and to create something of a centralized state. 1549, that same one, a series of significant reforms, especially in local self-government. Cities, vulos or counties, certain branches of government were elective. Elders, judges, and selo valniki or jurors were always elected by the community. And they were to judge all cases in economic disputes and minor criminal offenses without bribes and without red tape, he said. He wanted to expand the scope of local government while preserving the power of the center, the autocratic czar's power, which, of course, had a religious foundation. Now, a czar can't rule by meekness alone. Ivan said, "Some have mercy with judgment, others save with fear. Czars must always be prudent, sometimes meek, sometimes fierce. To the good, mercy and meekness, to the wicked, wrath and torment. If he does not have this, he is not a czar. The duties of a czar cannot be measured by the standards of a private individual. It's one thing to save one soul, another to care for many souls and bodies." Now, that's a very powerful distinction. Life of personal salvation is the ascetic life. Trying to be meek, trying to care for nothing material. But in public life, that's no longer possible. Asceticism exists, but in other areas. Because power is not something to be sought. It was crushing on him. Even bishops who were supposed to have, you know, been monastics, they're still obligated to provide, you know, care and discipline for others. He says, "Tsarist government requires fear, that is respect. Prohibition, restraint, the ultimate prohibition in view, the most evil madness of wicked men. And the Tsar himself will be punished by God if evil occurs through his own weakness. The key element is that the Tsar should have enough power to be completely independent of any interest group, of any power, of any military, of anything like that. A concept almost inconceivable in the West. Now people talk about absolute monarchy like they know what they're talking about. There is no such thing, nor could there ever be any such a thing. Now, I've said in the past, and it's correct, that absolute doesn't refer to power, it refers to responsibility. Of course, he has full legislative and judicial power, but there's practical limitations. One of his lines is, the rule of the many is like a woman's folly. See, if those are governed, in his mind, under both Ivan's and Tikhomirov, if those governed are not under a single authority, even if they are individually brave and wise, they will eventually fall to oligarchy. Royal authority can't even be limited by the Senate, in the sense that it's not fitting, as he says, for priests to exercise royal authority. The worst, though, is when the oligarchy tries to limit royal power, as they've done many times in Russian history, as you know from listening to me. He described his personal experience, the disasters, the unrest, the rebellions engendered by that period of time where he was too young to do anything about it. And the oligarchs were ruling as regency. Having plundered the royal treasury, he says, this is what these men did to the people. Now I'm quoting Ivan here. They plundered the property of those living in the villages, the most bitter torment. Who can calculate the misfortunes they inflicted on their neighbors? They made the inhabitants their slaves. They established their own slaves as nobles. They called themselves rulers and military leaders, but instead they created only injustice and disorder everywhere, collecting immeasurable bribes from the many and doing and saying everything according to those very same bribes. Money ruled. Little did he know what was going to happen in the 18th century. Little did he know how bad it was going to be, proving him correct. Only autocracy can put a stop to this predation. Tikhomirov also, you know, is a wise individual. We all realize that the power that a czar has, or any monarchy, has practical limitations. It's really constrained by its own principle. One of the main ones is the faith itself. Now, this is where it gets a little fuzzy, because Ivan condemned Kerensky's disobedience because Ivan had done nothing against Orthodoxy. I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head if Kerensky became a Roman Catholic. He might not have. Actually, come to think of it, I don't think he did. Now, I think it's more than that, but you get the point of view here. Anyway, Tikhomirov talks about the nature of the state itself. But there are things that simply don't concern the state, and that's the nature. You say the limit state power, it's saying that there are certain things that don't concern the state. And that really depends on social conditions. There are no interests that can be stated once and for all as not concerning state action. Of course, the Tsar has all right vested in him. Now, be very careful here. It's because the concept of legal right is created by the state itself. But it doesn't end there. In the nature of things, there's something higher than legal right. We all know it as natural law. It is natural, innate. And of course, this point of view has existed since ancient times. Natural law has been a guiding light for me in my political theory since I was in my early 20s. It's been manipulated and ripped apart and redefined. But we have to keep to what is essential about it. In the 17th century, it was universally recognized. They started talking about natural rights. That's a different story. But it didn't take very long that the concept of natural law was rejected as arbitrary and fanciful by the revolutionaries. So from the legal point of view, owning a right that is legally created, that is established by law one way or another, that's the only way a right can exist or function. If it's understood only by its legal sense, then of course, all natural rights are nothing more than a fantasy. But if we take into account the reality of political phenomena, then you have to take into account the laws of nature, which are far more powerful in the sense they're more fundamental than any law code. Legal right is a permission, the possibility of action, following from the code of laws. Natural law is that possibility which follows from natural necessity, according to the very laws and structure of human nature. It arises spontaneously, right? It's unquestionable. And only then is it recognized by law, and that's what makes a state legitimate. But even if, you know, what we have today, and in his day, he thought the nobility was, you know, on its way down and completely immoral. Natural law is still present. And it is still there in our consciousness and our conscience. It's indestructible. Natural law is innate. In other words, it's generated by the very nature of things. It's primary to legal law and generates, it generates written law. Written law has to be based on it. Going back to the earliest moments of human society, before the state, we see manifestations and mentions of natural law, the rights and obligations of people that grow out of simple actions dictated by human nature. Only there did written law arise. It didn't disappear with the emergence of the state and written law. No matter how binding written law might be, no matter what threats or punishments, is, it supports it. It's omnipotent only to the extent it does not meet the, or it does not oppose what natural law is. It arises from our psychological and social nature. It has a unchangeable foundation. Clearly, it can't be stipulated by the state. It can only be recognized by it. The spontaneous emergence, now I'm quoting Antigua Mandov here, the spontaneous emergence of natural law in society is precisely what necessitates the state's connection with society via the crown. If we were to assume that the state were to deny the legal standing of society, to ignore it, imagining that he could replace it with himself, such a state would be very quickly, would become lawless. Its legal right would gradually diverge from the constantly maturing natural law, or our understanding of natural law, I should say, would come into conflict with it, and the state would become an institution that would arouse universal horror and contempt, and it would be eventually overthrown, or simply be destroyed in and of itself. Law, of course, is built into our very nature. It has a role to play in the full realization of our nature. You know, in grad school, I read a lot of Thomas Aquinas. I was a Roman Catholic really until the second half of my graduate education. But he is very useful. Most of the church fathers accepted it. John Chrysostom especially, but people like him, as well as Aristotle, Human nature is a psychosomatic unity, reaching its end. It's perfected or fully realized by the habitual excellence of its intrinsic capabilities, the cognitive, the creative, the effective, the productive, whatever it might be. The highest, of course, is the human intellect, the power to understand the nature of things that exist. And of course, I think you probably already noted that no nominalist can believe in natural law. First of all, natural law itself is a universal, actually a series of universals, and they can't believe in anything like a human nature. The human soul potentially is everything. Now I'm deviating a little bit from Tikhon Medov. We call it a macrocosm, and it's such a cliche, but it's true. The human soul is potentially all things. It ranges over the entire universe of being. It brings the entire universe into a soul. Conjunction with our will, that is to say, our motive power. Intellect expands the soul to become all that it can be, or all that it should be, by a cognitive, affective, but not a physical union. Again, this is Aristotle as much as it is Thomas. And we all know what the highest object is, that which does not change, the good which will never, ever change. And of course, that is God himself. So law is an ordinance of reason directing activity towards some purpose, some goal. The highest end is therefore our ultimate fulfillment, the full realization of human nature. We might say, not so much happiness, but satisfaction. And I don't like the word happiness in these areas. Satisfaction, maybe even contentment. Law has a directly, it has a directive function. In order for an ordinance of reason to recognize public authority, we know in the monarchy, that the status of law should be promulgated, made public, or else it doesn't mean much. And both Aristotle, most of the church fathers, and Thomas, define the law as an ordinance of reason for the common good, made by him who has the care of the community and promulgated. We're talking about the monarchy, at least on things relative to the monarchy. And there, now we're back to Tikhon Medov here. There is a need through natural law for the supreme power to be in constant, close connection with society, with the nation. The supreme authority, the royal authority, has to have a clear consciousness. Tsar Nicholas II went through so many public visits to places. He didn't have much security. He didn't have an army like they do now, protecting them. But the monarchy, representing the supreme authority of the moral ideal, he is compelled to take particular care to ensure that it is constantly reflected within nature itself. I mean, natural law expresses the demands of the moral ideal, which arise under any given circumstance. But those demands have to be constantly heard. In a Christian monarchy, sensitivity to natural law is even more necessary. It is absolutely indisputable. And hence, nominalism is out of the question. Most of the Russian monarchs viewed their powers deriving from divine delegation. And therefore, there are duties imposed by the divine will, not just on the Tsar, but on those around him and everyone else. Those duties entitle the individual to everything necessary for their fulfillment. This individual right, so to speak, for the monarchy based on God's delegation is not subject to any infringement. It's a natural right of the individual, a right determined not by any written law, by the nature of man's relationship with God. All rights, if you want to use that terminology, have corresponding duties. Very clearly perceptible, as Tikhomirov says, by the very nature of things, that in all monarchies we actually see a potential, special respect for justice. And that consists precisely of conformity with truth and moral law, not necessarily written law. In oligarchies and democracies, by contrast, the written law prevails. I've mentioned many times, czars of Russia would eliminate debt, especially a peasant debt. They did it all the time. Lower taxes at a stroke of a pen. That is inconceivable in Western oligarchies. No one gets their debts forgiven. Rome developed the concept of written law, based on natural law, and writers such as Cicero. Boris Tchernin, as I mentioned before, he deals with another topic. That's a dangerous aspect of bureaucracy. Tchernin, I think I mentioned him last time, was a vaguely conservative writer of the era. And bureaucracy is an eternal problem. He says this: bureaucracy is the main organizer of a new state. From a convenient instrument of power, it can transform into an independent body with its own interests and standing between the monarch and the people. The bureaucracy's interest lay in wielding unlimited power in the administrative sphere. The goal is achieved by giving society as few opportunities as possible to act independently, by concealing the true state of affairs from the monarch. Through this, everything passes into the hands of the bureaucrats. The monarch's very will, despite his apparent autocracy, becomes dependent on it. As a result, the reign of official lies is established from above, while complete arbitrariness reigns below. Now, this comes up quite often in the Russian case, despite the fact that Russian bureaucracy was far smaller per capita than Germany, Britain, or France. Now, Tikhomirov says that the nature of bureaucracy at its best is the best system for the transmission of power, compared with all others. This is precisely because it exhibits the qualities of monarchy: the correct transmission of the received impulse from the top to the hierarchy to the bottom, specialization, efficiency, and unquestioning discipline. When it comes to transmission of this information, however, these things have a very dangerous downside. That includes the destruction of the bureaucrat's personality, the elevation of official duty above conscience, the destruction of independent thinking, especially about the good of the nation. In fact, the denigration of everything in the interest of mechanical perfection. And he says still, one could imagine what a hotbed of general corruption this soulless mechanism could become if it became the supreme authority over the nation. Now, bureaucracy is inherently an executive power area. In America, bureaucracy is within, you know, the presidential cabinet. This is how laws are transmitted from one mind to another. As we mentioned, it has to be promulgated. This is how it is. You did have movements within the Russian bureaucracy, which is something very odd that you didn't have elsewhere. But Tigmino's idea is the more any official suppresses his independent, unsolicited thoughts about the public good, the more he thinks about his personal interests. And that could create a tremendous egotism, ready for any kind of predation and abuse. So what the necessity is, bringing the official closer to the nation. The point is keeping the bureaucracy from becoming a soulless and indifferent machine. Now, Russia had done fairly well in this respect. Since at the local level, there really wasn't any bureaucracy. Certainly, there was very little at the Volost or the commune level, which were the two areas, two institutions that the average peasant dealt with almost every day. Bureaucracy is not something the Russian church was known for. Things just kind of got done. We all know that there's the cliche about the czar is good, but the bureaucrats are evil. And quite often that's true. The point is to safeguard the crown from being seized by his own executive department. In European states, this happens quite often. How powerful bureaucratic usurpation becomes when the necessary safeguards for control over the crown are undermined. And in America, there are no limits to the size of the bureaucracy, I guess except financial. But Tikhomirov goes farther. He says, the complete system of a refined bureaucracy was completed in Russia with the establishment of ministries, which the crown elevated in a position sort of like that of a premier. Decisions of ministers were supposedly decided by the Tsar himself, but the actual progress of affairs could only be monitored through their reports to the monarch. It's really hard to, you know, it's extremely difficult to maintain a smooth operation, since the only way a Tsar can know things is that the minister reports to the crown. This is why people like Tsar Nicholas I had his own separate institution dedicated entirely to sometimes the history books call it secret police, whatever. But the point was to keep a watch on what bureaucracy was doing. Peter Simonov, he's quoted by Tikhomirov. He died in 1914. He was a famous explorer and geologist, later in life becoming a major political figure. So this man was deeply respected. Here's what he says, characterizing the consequences of this. The bureaucracy manages to protect itself from royal supervision. It's characterized by four main negative properties. First, it considers and decides every case, not from the point of view of the benefit of the state, but from the point of view of the post which has received, of the ministry itself. Second, it's constantly concerned and sharpens its abilities and ingenuity in order to deflect responsibility from itself in each case. Third, it sharpens itself in inventing ways of circumventing laws and regulations. So as, for example, to send a case outside the established institutions to secure a pre-decision for the case, to drag it out by lots of correspondence and other, you know, et cetera, court cases, whatever. Fourth, it directs its abilities, knowledge, and talents not to achieving the most useful for the people, the final resolution of the case, to present it today in one light and direction, tomorrow in another, depending on the changing tastes of the changing authorities, and achieves virtuosity, balancing views on the case and inventing compromises that delay its full resolution. In an effort to shirk responsibility or circumvent the law, bureaucrats eagerly bring matters to the crown, whose signature often covers what the responsible authority should have carried out itself. In other words, he's saying no independent authority should act independently. I'm sorry, that no bureaucratic authority should act independently. Again, he says, a multitude of methods and techniques have emerged, have become ingrained in the bureaucratic mind. Clerical replies, various squabbles over jurisdiction, unnecessary correspondence, all designed to push a matter of responsibility off their shoulders, forcing the matter to wander for years without any result. Now, here's the problem. The most harmful consequence. It's impossible to discern. You're talking about from the point of view of the average person who's bringing, you know, who has to work with this. Where is the monarch's power involved? Where does it end? And where does the bureaucracy's power involved? Where is it? You can't blame the monarch for the corruption of a bureaucracy. Especially if he's completely unaware of it. It's very difficult for him to be aware of it. It's unjust to blame that on the monarchy, despite Russia having a relatively small number of bureaucrats compared to the rest of Europe. The plundering of the monarchy. This is what Simonov calls it. And we see it all the time. We see it especially in the 18th century. The plundering by bureaucrats leads, according to Simonov, to the worst form of governance, the semblance of oligarchy, but not even an independent one. It's composed of known permanent figures, but rather a random and frequently changing group. The de facto ruling oligarchs, having gained power, nevertheless hide, wherever and whenever they need, behind the supreme authority, drawing from its sanctions irresponsibility for themselves and thereby compromising it. The worst problem that occurred in the 18th century is that it began, that the common people began to separate themselves from the crown. They couldn't tell the difference between the bureaucracy and the monarchy. They started to blame failures of the bureaucratic life on the crown itself. So despite everything, and he does say that at its best, bureaucracy is probably the best way of making a law, to promulgate it, and hence to enforce it. Prior to this, it was generally based on noble families and in specific regions, and they carried it out. There may be some use for that, but... And that's what I have for on monarchist statehood. Very difficult to summarize. He certainly condemns revolutionaries, but more importantly, he lays out these historical understandings that led him away from it all. Yes, of course, it was the murder of Alexander II. When he fled to Geneva, he was reading constantly. The revolutionaries are simply wrong when it came to understanding Western history. Now, let me go to Why I'm No Longer a Revolutionary from 1888. Let me read a passage now. The left intelligentsia has this deeply rooted idea that we are living in some kind of period of destruction, which it is believed will end in a terrible upheaval with rivers of blood, the crack of dynamite, and so on. Afterwards, it is assumed, the period of creation will begin. This social conception, something like the political reflection of the old ideas of Cuvier, the school of sudden geographical catastrophes, is completely erroneous. Cuvier is the founder of scientific zoology and comparative anatomy, also an opponent of evolution. His conception, he saw that, you know, he didn't think there was any evidence for evolution at all. He died in 1832, but evolutionary theory was still around with people like Lamarck and St. Hilary. He saw the world as going through cyclical creations and destructions of life by global extinction events like floods. Oh, and he was also one of the first to characterize human races, which is very exciting. Let me continue. In fact, in real life, destruction and creation go hand in hand. They're inconceivable, one without the other. The destruction of one phenomenon occurs, in fact, because something else has been created in it, in its place. And conversely, the formation of the new is nothing other than the destruction of the old. He who has the power to destroy, but is powerless to immediately create the new, produces only necrosis on the part of the social organism. But in most cases, the destruction itself is purely fictitious. For example, an individual is destroyed, but the idea, or the class, or the institution represents, continues to remain in full force and health. This is something similar to what Dostoevsky talked about in his Demons, or The Possessed, whatever name you want to call it. Terrorism was not considered a bad thing like we consider it. Use the word intelligentsia, we really automatically mean leftist. That's really where it came from. This period of destruction, rivers of blood, and then that will automatically lead to a period of creation, generally by these same people. And there's no reason to believe that whatsoever. It's a fantasy, especially given the low level of maturity of many of these terrorist organizations, which he knows very well. Speaking of terrorism, let me quote him again here. Terrorism is a system of political struggle that is either powerless or superfluous. It is powerless if the revolutionaries lack the means to overthrow the government. It is superfluous if they do. Meanwhile, it is harmful in moral and intellectual terms. The authors of the protest, that is to say, against him leaving the left and throwing them all into an absolute crisis, however, attacked me particularly heatedly on this point. And the weak arguments of the so-called old pagans, as they call themselves, can exert influence on the youth precisely here, since they flatter their accustomed points of view. See, if you believe that you're in a period of destruction, then murder and literal destruction is not a bad thing under any, you know, you're bringing in the new. The old has to give way to the new. And this was the very childish point of view of the terrorist groups that he was involved with. More significantly here, once convinced that this was an insignificant handful who engaged in political assassinations because they lacked the strength to do anything seriously dangerous, the government, in my opinion, showed no further signs of disarray and adopted a rigid system and followed its own path without a moment's hesitation. From this perspective, in terms of political change, the significance of terror is approximately zero. But it has the most harmful effects down below, on the revolutionaries themselves, and everywhere its influence reaches. It fosters complete contempt for society, for the people, for the country. It fosters a spirit of self-will incompatible with any social order. In a purely moral sense, what power can be more immeasurable than the power of one man that has the life of another in his hands? It is a power that many, and certainly not the worst, deny even to society itself. And yet, this power is appropriated by a handful of people, and they kill, not even for some atrocity, for anything that would elevate their victims beyond the bounds of humanity. They kill, so to speak, for political crime. But what exactly is this political crime? The fact that the legitimate government, recognized by the population, does not want to fulfill the self-proclaimed demands of a handful of people, these revolutionaries, who are so deeply aware of themselves as an insignificant minority, that they don't even try to start an open struggle with the government. Alexander II was extremely popular. Most of the czars were. Alexander was. Nicholas was. It had been sanctioned by history and the church. Even if you want to call yourself a vanguard, make it sound extraordinary, put whatever label you want on it, the government really wasn't harmed by it. Lots of innocent people, however, were killed. He says, one hears a lot of talk from these people about, quote, returning power to the people. But that's empty words, and we all know it. After all, the people haven't asked for any of this. On the contrary, they constantly demonstrate a willingness to smash the heads of their liberators. One of the desperate romanticism of the revolutionaries allows them to live in such fictions and treat Russian power as one might treat a power of any usurper. The Russian Tsar didn't steal power. He received it from his solemnly chosen successors, ancestors. And to this day, the people, with all their might, at every opportunity, demonstrate their readiness to support the cause of their forefathers with all their might. And this is tough to deny. So it isn't just that killing Alexander II was going too far. He began to realize that the monarchy had a point, in fact, many points. Returning power to the people. This is a tiny handful of guys and girls. There are a lot of women involved in this, of course. No one asked for it. No one wants it. And they condemn the government for various things, and they condemn the government really because they're not immediately putting their agenda into action. Even though, in the past, the monarchy has been quite willing to compromise with these groups. Especially in labor area, in labor's, we talked about this in the Lena gold mine incident. But that's not what they want to hear. And of course, then they'll lie to their people saying, "Oh no, they're telling us that we're going to kill you all," or something stupid like that. They didn't have the web back then. Here's something else from that essay. The Russian way of thinking, and now he says, I'm speaking of the leftist intelligentsia, is characterized by two things. First, a lack of taste and respect for facts. And second, an unbounded trust in theory and hypotheses that somehow sanctify their desires. These must stem from their brain's limited capacity for intense mental work. A mind that tires too quickly cannot cope with the myriad facts that fill life and develops an aversion to it all. Theoretical hypotheses, on the contrary, oh, that's what they love. Provides a seeming understanding of phenomenon without any of the effort. These phenomena are natural among a people who have just begun to learn, because they're students. But they must be recognized, understood, and corrected. Students should be especially mindful of this, as they are the ones who are specifically engaged in the development of their own thought. Our social thought, meaning intelligentsia, is overflowing with all sorts of prejudices, hypotheses, and theories, each more comprehensive and ethereal than the next. Mental training is so concentrated on generalities and general considerations that I fear it may actually diminish the capacity for correct thinking. I think you know what he's getting at here. You see it quite often. They're forcing events into their own categories. Whether they belong there or not, it doesn't matter. They're forcing any kind of political event. You know, the concept that workers are communists, and when the Communist Party took over, that they were the spokesman for the working class. And then say the working class says X, Y, and Z. Not because they've actually gone and spoken to them. No, because their theory says this is what they need or want. Marxism is notorious for this. Now, of course, my first love was political theory. But political theory has to be connected with a living, breathing group of people, hence the Russian stuff. But theory by itself, it's a group of students, you know. They sound intelligent. They sound like they know things, but they don't really have to work too hard to spout the lines. They're kids. Yeah, they're killing people and their kids. Students overwhelmingly were the membership of many of these terrorist groups in the 1870s and 1880s. I mentioned last time the people's freedom, sometimes you call them people's will, was entirely Jewish at the upper level. Tikhomirov was one of the few Gentiles. Mark Natanson, Vera Finger, Aaron Zendilovich, Leo Deutsch, Pavel Axelrod. Another Gentile was Yakov Stefanovich, and the poor Sophia Pelskaya. This poor girl who, I think I mentioned this last time, who was totally ignored by her family. And it's almost like a cult. The revolutionaries were the first ones to listen to her and flatter her and say how smart she is. But no one else did. You know, she was the weirdo. And so she became, from the upper nobility, she became almost a symbolic leader of the group. But Jews clearly outnumbered the Gentiles. I never think that the so-called populist movement believed in any kind of agrarianism. They just simply redefine these terms. They forced their own theories onto the peasantry. They even dressed up as peasants and tried to walk into the villages, telling them what they need with tremendous arrogance. No wonder they got beaten up and sent over to the cops. And hence, terrorism was a response to the fact that it fails. Okay, now they deserve to die. Here's what he says about the Tsar, or Tsarism, I should say, the monarchy. I look at the question of autocratic power like this. First of all, it's a result of Russian history that requires no recognition and cannot be destroyed by anyone, as long as there are tens of millions in the country who know and want nothing else in politics. It would be unacceptable to disrespect the historical will of the people, not to mention the fact that it's very strong and the life always has some compelling basis. Therefore, every Russian must recognize the authority established in Russia. When thinking about improvements, one must think about how to achieve them under autocracy. By adhering to it, one can criticize. And he mentions Kislev and Milutin. These are so-called enlightened bureaucrats. They were involved in various state reforms. Not yet, weren't too bad, but they were liberals, and they wanted to lead a bureaucratic revolution of some sort or other. Now, one of the things that the left was saying at the time is, under an autocratic monarchy, you can't really have culture. Oh, so I guess Pushkin, Gogol, and Tolstoy don't count. I mean, I could go through 10 million things. And of course, they were atheists, so you know the church didn't matter. Not to mention that the form of government doesn't exactly exhaust the life of a country. But everyone's personal political ideas, duty to the country compels one to extract the greatest benefit for it from any situation in which it finds itself. He says, the revolutionary movement is not the cause, but only the symptom of the evil from which contemporary Russia suffers most, contemporary Russia in 1888. This evil, as I've said before, is a lack of seriously trained minds in the educated class, the result of which all the intellectual work of this class is of very low quality. The stigma of the shortcomings created by half education often lay upon the work of even the most outstanding talents. This is the evil that is destroying the best qualities of the Russian nature, one that helped our ancestors become a great country, and now we're undermining it. The fight against evil is, in my opinion, the most important task of the present time. This very evil, Russia's fate, depends essentially on whether or not it can develop a core of mature minds strong enough to set the tone for the rest of the educated class and their own work, thought, and research outline the most important points for Russia's development. This requires, first of all, a strong shakeup of minds and general revision of our social and political points of view. I said before that the monarchy didn't like the idea of a political party. It didn't even make sense from a royal point of view. You had tons of first, I mean, he's wrong to say this as far as royalists are concerned. There were tons of first-rate royal theorists within the 19th century. But it seems that political work was being done by the half-educated. Well, we have the same problem today. And he's right to say this is the evil. This is the evil of evils when the brain doesn't even work right. And it's that half education that leads to terrorism, that leads to the belief that ideals are actually real things. Finally, let me quote one more time. This is from Appendix 2. Revolutionaries are quite sincerely convinced that they're the forefront of historical progress. In their view, human development brings one closer to them, but moving away from them is a decline. Now he's talking about the battle between himself and Peter Lavrov. Lavrov was the founder of something called Narodism as a political theory. He died in 1900. His point of view was never quite coherent. His analysis of political Russian historical development led him to believe that Russia's the way to bring socialism to Russia is different from the way someone like Marx would. Russian nation has no foundation in their thought. They were at war with the ethnos, and that's very true. They wanted to recreate it. When they talk about the Russian culture, Russian people, Russian nation, they're not talking about what we mean by the Russian nation at the time. It was something they have in their minds, the new man. They go on about Russia being isolated from the European development by the Mongol conquest, which is in itself not true. And he saw Russia as backward, et cetera, et cetera. So he thought that the socialist revolution was possible using tactics that involved the peasantry. And, of course, the intelligentsia, which a unique group that didn't have any class affiliations, who, according to him, were undamaged by the past. He was significant for about two decades, mostly 1860s and 1870s. Anyway, between Mr. Tikhomirov, says Peter Lavrov, and the workers of peaceful progress in Russia, there's a huge difference. They cannot be treated equally. And he's quoting now, some of them may be in our ranks tomorrow, he explains. Explains. We will receive them with joy. Their mistake? They did not go far enough. They did not retreat. Nothing prevents them from going further. Tikhomirov's position is entirely different. He saw and turned away. He was at the forefront, and he retreated. Those are Lavrov's words against Tikhomirov. And a lot of that was to cover over the fact that his defection sent the left into an absolute meltdown. Not just psychologically, but in terms of their own organization. Because all he did was write and write afterwards. And it was very tough for him, for them to refute him. How do they claim to be the voice of the people when the voice of the people hates them? Karl Marx had this notion, really developed by Engels, but elements of the working class are simply brainwashed. He calls it a false consciousness. Even in fact, the overwhelming majority of the workers have this point of view. Well, they just don't know any better. We have to teach them. So, we're the vanguard of this, of the movement of history towards its end. So that's what we have to do. And if they don't come along, well, going to the people movement was a miserable failure, and that's where terrorism ultimately came from. Terrorism was a major element in Russian life from the 1860s until 1917, or really until the outbreak of the war, I should say. Killing people, low-level bureaucrats, cops, sometimes ordinary people who were mistaken for one of these people. Numbers were fairly high, depending on the year. Alexander III was able to smash it. When Nicholas II took over, it revived again. They didn't have the support of the population. Solzhenitsyn is very clear when he says they were going into factories and forcing them at the barrel of a gun to strike. They were treated better than any other factory worker in Europe. They had decent wages with a very low cost of living. They had to force it out of them. There wasn't a food shortage. They had to blow up the train tracks to make a food shortage. And said, oh my God, this is how the government's falling apart. Peter Lavrov talks about the workers of peaceful progress, and that's something that we hear today, you know, the peaceful protesters. Nothing seems to change anymore. But it's always fun to deal with a former leftist, especially a terrorist, who has not only broken with the left, but has become a major figure in right-wing royalist and nationalist thinking. And I took a few excerpts from, you know, Royalist Statehood, Monarchist Statehood is, you know, four volumes. I took some of my favorite parts of it. There's much else. And I hope you got a little bit of a taste for the book. I don't know if it's translated in English. It should be in English. I bet you it is. I only read it in Russian at first. I have it in hard copy somewhere. But he is an extraordinary man. And it took a lot of courage because these were killers. They did it anyway. The Soviets left them alone so long as he didn't talk anymore. Because the Soviets were often opposed to the Narodniks, as they were called, the so-called agrarians. So he opposed them, okay. But he lived through World War I, Bolshevik Revolution, really didn't say a word. He had no choice, but he couldn't. He refused to leave his country, which is understandable. But his legacy is in especially this. This is supposed to be his magnum opus, this massive work from which we're dealing with a few small but I think representative passages from it, understanding what kind of thinker he was. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.